Welcome to All the Things with Monique Dusson from the Center for Biblical Unity and Theology Mom, Krista Bontrager. And now, here's Krista and Monique.
Hello. We are live tonight and we are back. We've been off for a couple of weeks with pre-recorded shows because you have been away on a big trip that we're going to be talking about tonight.
Yes, I can't believe the trip is already done. But for those of you who were not aware, I went back to South Africa for 2 weeks and it was a very quick trip. It was a whirlwind trip. I felt like it was just go, go, go. But it was the best go, go, go that I have had in a very long time.
Yeah, so we're going to do a full field report tonight from Monique's trip to South Africa. We got pictures, we've got a video, we've got a lot of information to update people about with regard to, you know, some developments and things happening at the ministry. So you'll definitely want to stay tuned to the end. I also want to let people know to make sure to subscribe to the weekly newsletter for All the Things. It's not something we talk about a whole lot, but if you go to allthethingsshow.com to our website, you will see a way to sign up for the newsletter. In fact, if you just go there and you wait 2 seconds, you'll see a little thing pop up and you can fill in your name and address and your email, and we'll send you, whenever we have a show, we send out a little preview the day before so you can know if we're having a show, if it's live, and what the topic is and all of that. So go make sure that you are signed up for the newsletter. That is the best way to stay in touch with us as well. So So we've been, we recorded some shows before you left and we didn't tell anyone that you were leaving. So people haven't heard from us live in a while, but maybe we should remind people about the Giving Tuesday campaign that we did back in November to help fundraise for this mission trip. And so first of all, we should probably start off by thanking all the donors who make this show possible and made your trip possible.
Yes, thank you so much. Back in November, right before Thanksgiving, we had Giving Tuesday. And one of the things that we were raising funds for was for a trip for me to take back to South Africa. I had been invited by a ministry there called Apologetics South Africa or Apologetics SA. I'm actually wearing, don't know if you can see it, I am wearing their merch right now. While I was there, they gave me this dress. And if you look on it, it has a woman's face. She's wearing a headdress and it says Apologetics SA. And so they invited me mid last year, to come and speak at their women's retreat and talk about unity within the body of Christ. And so that is what I did. I was a little on the fence, didn't know if we were going to go, but we wanted to raise money because they're a very small ministry. And so any of the speakers that they have come over actually raise their own funds to go, just like we would do for a regular missions trip. And yeah. And so then we serve them as we're in country. And they've had many of the people that you would probably recognize come and visit them as well. So it was a good time. I can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Well, maybe let's start as we're getting into it, because I know you have a big heart for Africa in general, South Africa in particular, but you've also done work previously in Zambia. Yeah. And I think you visited Botswana. But your heart is just, you love the people of Africa. You have so many connections and ties in South Africa. And so I wanted to start maybe with a little bit of just a tiny bit, you're not a historian, but to just put some, a little bit of historical context in place for some of our younger viewers that may not even really understand some of the the historical context of race issues in South Africa or even know what apartheid is?
Yeah, so South Africa was plagued by apartheid. It was a system that ran from, I want to say, the end of the 40s, maybe a little bit before that, through 1994. And in 1994, Nelson Mandela was freed from prison. And I want to say within, you know, months later, the entire apartheid regime fell. And so, yes, when we think about Nelson Mandela is a major figure in South Africa. He was jailed for 27 years. It started out with accusations of treason and wanting to overthrow the government, the apartheid, you know, government and regime there. And he was originally sentenced, I want to say, for 5 years. And then he tried to flee the country. And there were some other accusations and charges. And he was sentenced to life imprisonment, if I'm not mistaken. But he actually served 27 years between 2 to 3 different jail cells. The longest stint was served on an island called Robben Island. And it's like an hour's ferry ride from Cape Town over to Robben Island. Robben Island used to be a leper colony or a leper area. And eventually that is where they ended up keeping political prisoners. And so, yes, Robben Island is now it's turned into a, not a museum, but like a tourist attraction where people can go, you can take tours. They've actually had some of the guards and some of the prisoners come back to Robben Island for reconciliation to hear the experience of those who were jailed, but then also hear the experience of the officers who, you know, imprisoned the prisoners. And now when you take tours, you might get a, you know, officer who was actually in charge of the jail or a warden, or you might get a prisoner who was actually held at Robben Island. I've done the Robben Island tour a number of times and have had different prisoners who were actually in Robben Island.
So let me ask you, apartheid was kind of a system of separating the races, and it was a government sponsored system of certain people. If you belong to this ethnicity, you live over here, or you go to these schools. And if you're this ethnicity, you live over here, you go to these schools. So it's kind of a, it was maybe for lack of a better analogy, like kind of Jim Crow type laws, but on the national level.
Yes. And so it would have been comparable to maybe a Jim Crow, but also like redlining and things like that.
Okay.
It was definitely a political structure that was enforced across much of South Africa. It determined where people live. So they had what's known as the Groups Areas Act, I believe it's called, where, you know, it distinguished where colored people live, where blacks could live, what places were for whites, how much land a black person could buy. People needed to carry a pass or a pass book called the pass laws. And it allowed people to go to certain areas, but this book definitely made sure that you were in the right area at the right time. You had to show proof that you belonged in that area if you were black or colored or non-white. It impacted the schools. Apartheid also relocated people. So it, you know, meant because of the way the districts were now structured, or districts within provinces were now structured, certain people had to move. And so you get areas like where I worked on the Cape Flats, which is a largely colored area, where, you know, these people were now moved into, you know, places like Lotus River or Grassy Park, or, you know, some of these other highly concentrated colored areas. So it was much more than just, you know, you can't live here. It was about buying land. It was about where people could physically travel. If you were not white, you were not allowed to vote. It was a lot, okay. A lot more than just that. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe talk to us a little bit about kind of the major streams of ethnic groups that are there? Because I know based on our conversations, South Africa is not just black and white. I mean, there's a variety of languages, cultures, kind of all coming together. Maybe talk to us about what those major streams are.
Yes, yeah, so there are 11 national languages, and I don't know all of them. I think I probably know five or six. There's English, Afrikaans, Zulu, Xhosa. Xhosa is the primary language that people are familiar with because of the movie Wakanda, where they have the clicks and things like that. English, Afrikaans, Zulu, Xhosa, Sotho, Venda. And the other five I am not as familiar with. But yes, so there are those national languages. But then when you think about people groups, you can think of the Afrikaner people or Afrikaans being your white Afrikaans. You have colored people, which are a mixture of white and then Khoisan. So it would be, you know, white British or Dutch or French mixed with the indigenous people to the land, the Khoisan. And then you have, so white, colored, African. You also have Asian. And I am missing one. There's white, black, Asian, colored, and I can't believe I'm missing one. Indian. Yes, thank you. Indian. Yeah. And so those are the five primary people groups. There are others, but when I think about South Africa, I think of Black African, and within the Black African group, there are other, you know, tribes. It's not just I'm Black African, and so we belong to just one tribe. There are different tribes, and then Indian, Asian, white, and colored.
So when you lived in South Africa in 2014 to 2018, and then you had been there a couple of times on short-term mission trips prior to that, what progress do you think the country had made at that point from the Mandela days and the fall of apartheid to when you were there? Like, was it just because I keep reading about even in evangelical books, I was rereading the section today and Eric Mason's Woke Church book on where he has a little short discussion on page 151, I believe. On South Africa and the racial reconciliation efforts. Like, did you see just harmony and lots of kumbaya and, you know, like what progress had they made since the fall of apartheid in the late 80s, early 90s?
So the Truth and Reconciliation Council is what most people refer to when they're thinking about South Africa and thinking about the repair that's been made. One of the things that I definitely saw was going to someplace like Robben Island, where you know that this is where many of those conversations were had about, you know, this is what it was like for me as a prisoner, but then this is what it was like for me as a warden. And this is why I, you know, continued to work here. Or this is, you know, the way that I was raised and how my family thought about things. And so there was definitely conversation that was meant to be able to build reconciliation. I think one of the things that I also saw post, you know, apartheid was the movement of people. So not all Black people lived in townships and not all white people lived just in white areas, and colored people also lived in places that they historically couldn't live. Now, because of apartheid, there definitely is more segregation than I think what I've experienced here in the United States, or not, it's not even a by law segregation. It's just as this is where we live. And so this is kind of, you know, where we live and what we do, and this almost familiarity of the area. So when you think about a township, you know, not township living isn't easy, but I've wondered if there's a familiarity of the township. And so many people continue to stay in the township. But you also get people who move into, you know, who are Black, who move into other areas. You might move into a colored area, or a white family that's in a colored area, or a colored person that's in a white area. And that would not have been possible under the apartheid regime. And so, or even, you know, being out past a certain time or being in a certain area after a certain time, you know, and having that freedom of movement. Movement was very restricted under the apartheid regime. And so I think those are some of the progresses that have been made post-apartheid. I think the idea that people can vote. You know, I don't have to sit and allow just, you know, the white constituents to be able to tell me what my life should look like. I also have a say and I can vote and can, you know, help make change in my nation as well.
So there's a quick question on here from Natalie, our friend. What was defined as colored? Did I understand correctly that colored was a different group from Indians and black?
Yes, you did understand correctly. Colored would be those of mixed race. And so they are mixed white and indigenous. They would not be black because a black person would be someone who is specific to that tribal group.
So
They have no mixture of blood.
you're using
But
black and indigenous as synonyms.
yes, if I'm thinking about synonyms correctly. So a black person, a black African would be someone who has no mixture of blood.
And they are a tribal member. And
Usually
they
they
would be
belong to.
considered native to that area. And so that's what you're calling indigenous.
Well, there's another indigenous group called the Khoisan,
Okay.
and they are an indigenous African group, but it's different facial features than,
Different tribe.
you know, that's a good question. I should ask my colored
Sorry, I'm
friends.
trying
No,
to make you
that's a really good
parse
question.
out the ethnicities of South Africa on a live stream, but
I
all
know.
right.
I yeah. But the when you think about a black African, it is definitely like a tribal African. But when I think about the Khoisan, I do believe that they would also participate in tribe, but they there's a different look. They're usually of lighter skin. It's just different. And
Okay.
so
So
I
colored,
yeah, I would
though,
have
would be
to
a mixture of
they
a
would be
white
mixed race.
person with a what's called a black person and a
No,
black,
not always.
not always.
This is what
Okay.
I'm saying. This is what I'm saying. The Khoisan, the colored group comes from the Khoisan and the mixture of like a white French person, a white Dutch person, a
Okay.
white English person. That's where the people group of colored originated from,
Okay.
was this mixture of blood. Now you can take someone like Trevor Noah. I believe Trevor Noah is half Swiss and half Xhosa. He is considered colored because he has mixed blood. He is
Okay.
not truly white nor black, black African in the tribal sense. He is colored. He's of mixed blood, mixed
Okay.
race.
So when you were there, when you were living there in 2014 to 2018, did you notice like some progress and migration away from apartheid? But did people still live, did different groups still live fairly segmented in into their own places? Colored people sort of live in this area. Black people live in townships for the most part. Like, were people still pretty much self-segregating?
Yes. Now, I will say toward the end of my time there, what I noticed in the township that I used to work in was that there was a lot of colored people moving into this township. I was completely surprised because when I first started working there in 2010, it was an all black township. And what I noticed in the area where I lived in Jamestown, there were two to three, maybe, white families that had moved into Jamestown, maybe one or two. But there were a few that had actually moved into Jamestown. And so you can see the movement and the migration. When I lived in an area called Paradise Kloof. And that area was all white. It was an all white area. And what I was noticing was that a colored family had moved in. And so you could see the slow progress, but primarily, yes, people did live in, like, blacks lived in townships and colored people did not primarily, and white people did not.
So what, how did people feel about you as an African American living in South Africa? Like, how did they view somebody like you when you lived there?
It just depends on the person. It depends on the group. So I largely had no issue, you know, with as far as me as a person, I didn't have a ton of issues. There are definite thoughts about Americans overall. And I think that can get, those lines can get blurred because while you might like me, you might not necessarily like my nation. There are thoughts that I have, you know, or comments that I've heard from some like Black Africans, like thinking of like a Zulu or a Xhosa person in regards to what it means to be African American. I've been told that it's very interesting that I would use the term African American because truly I'm American.
So they would view you by and large as being an American, not as an African. They're kind of confused by that label. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's why aren't you just calling yourself American? Because you're American. You don't hail from the African continent. Now that's a debatable point. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. But that was their perception about you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think more so than anything, the conversation will come down to Americans and what are Americans doing.
I see.
Not necessarily, you know, me being Black American. But I was, I would say, largely very well received, very loved on and things like that. It would be the oddity for someone to say something, you know.
Now, if they were just looking at you, did they think you were a colored person until you started talking?
Most of the time, yes. Okay. There are things that, you know, as an American, I do. And like always having a water bottle with me. Americans, we carry our water bottles everywhere. Other people don't do that. And so that was something that would give me away. Or when I would have interns come over from the States or teams, you know, from the States with the organization I served with, they would have their water bottles. And then they'd be like, there's the Americans because they have their water bottles, our Stanley cups. And so there were those kind of things, but by and large, I've had people just automatically, you know, speak to me in Afrikaans. I was heading to Cape Town on this trip and there was an elderly woman standing next to me and she almost fell. And so I put my arm out to catch her and she turned and she began to thank me in Afrikaans. It isn't, you know, that.
And naturally strange. You spoke back to her in Afrikaans.
As best I could, but nobody really has time for my Afrikaans. Well, it is a very special situation.
You know, this is great conversation because we've never really talked publicly about, you know, kind of your story and your thoughts about South Africa, even though we've been doing the show for a long time and people are always very curious. Maybe talk about your mindset at that time when you were serving as a missionary in 2014 to 2018. Like, what were you doing? Because people always are asking about that. What were you doing and what was the lens through which you were doing that work?
Yeah, so I was initially going to like teach very beginner dance with just elementary school students or primary school students. So in South Africa, there's no middle school. They only have primary and high school. Primary goes from grade R, which would be kindergarten, straight through to grade 7. You graduate grade 7 and then you do grades 8 through 12 in high school. And so I went to teach dance and then the principal at the school that I was at heard that I had a background in social service and asked if I wouldn't speak with one of their students who was just experiencing some issues in the classroom. And I did that. And then there was another student and another student after that. And so then I started to just meet with young people and hear their stories and give them an outlet to be able to talk about what life was like for them. We play games, we do artwork and things like that. And I also talked with teachers about their experiences working with, you know, sometimes 50, 55 kids in a classroom and having, you know, at least 2/3 of the students in that classroom with some form of trauma. So I would sit and talk to them. They would refer their students to me to come and spend time with Miss Mo and talk about all of their feelings and what's happening in their homes. And so that was what I was doing. I was talking to young people. I ended up expanding beyond that initial primary school that I was at to a few other schools in the area and just spent time talking to kids. That was my every day was, how can I talk to a kid today? How can we go for a walk today and get some bilateral movement in to help them with some of their processing?
So when you were doing that work, what was the culture in the country like that, and when we're talking about trauma here, we should maybe clarify, because this word has been so hijacked. We're not talking about my parents disagreed with me and hurt my feelings. Like, that's not the trauma we're talking about. We're not talking about things that really should be a matter of resiliency in a normal child. We're talking about real traumas. Like, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the area in which you were working and why a school would have a need for somebody like you. The trauma would be so pervasive that they would need that kind of help.
Yeah, so the area that I worked in is a highly violent area, high drug use, high gang violence, high poverty, high crime. And so many of the kids that I worked with had experienced, you know, a death in their family, a death of a parent, had drugs being, you know, sold in and out of their homes. I worked with kids who had been trafficked. I worked with children who, you know, one parent had harmed the other severely. The children that I worked with had seen horrific things or had horrific things happen to them. And that is what the need was. Now, South Africa itself, is, I would say, definitely a country that experiences more violence or more violent crimes. It definitely has a higher poverty rate. It has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, if not the highest. And so because of the issues that were present within the community, or yeah, the community that I was in, you know, having someone for a child to talk to was such a blessing for that child, but also for the teacher, for the school, helping children be able to ground themselves and to come back into their body, so to speak, was just a benefit. And so it wasn't just me, but, you know, as time passed or progressed, I ended up with an assistant, and I ended up having interns from other local universities there, but then also interns from the States would come over. And so that's why the situation was needed. I didn't realize that when I moved over. I thought, hey, I'm going to go over for a year. I'm only going over for a year because I really like America and I like, you know, being able to see my family and things like that. I had no idea it would turn into 4 years.
So I want to make sure that we circle back to kind of your mindset and your perspective at that time. We've talked, you know, over the years very briefly about how you came out of critical race theory, but we've never really talked about how that impacted your work in South Africa and that framework as you were a missionary over there, like bringing that mindset to it. Did that shape anything that you do, or did it inform your work there in any way?
I think that it was always the underlying motive, like operation for me, but I wasn't talking to kids about their, you know, oppression or things like that. That was just my reason why I was doing it, helping to free a kid or helping to help a child like progress beyond the oppressive systems that they were forced to live under. The organization that I partnered with while I was in South Africa also had that same, you know, idea and mentality, looking at how do we protest, how do we stand up for the marginalized, and, you know, all of those more socialist leaning ideas. And so that's what I was doing. I recently, or that's where my mindset was. I recently came across a journal that I kept, and I had all of these thoughts about, white people and, just all of my little journal writings and things like that. And I was like, wow, I can't believe, how far I've come in my thinking. And, at that time, I wouldn't have thought that there was anything wrong with the way that I was thinking about white people, and just could have acknowledged, like, yes, like, you're white, and we might be friendly, or you can be a friend, but we also are very clear that whiteness and white systems are the reason for this poverty, are the reasons for this drug use. And by, protesting or standing up for the marginalized, that's the way to help a child overcome, some of these things. Now, there were also other ways, teaching a child leadership skills and
Right.
independence and, some of those other things, but the main issue was the marginalization that, or the oppression that was done or inflicted by whites.
So in 2018, you were scheduled to come back to the States for a brief trip, and you were coming home to see some family. And that in on June the 3rd of 2018 is when you and I met in person. For the first time prior to that, we had been talking to each other on Zoom and Messenger for about 7 months by that point. But it maybe right before we were going to head into the break here, maybe just explain really briefly why you ended up coming off the mission field. It was sort of an emergency situation while you were here in the States. You were only planning to be here about, I think, 8 to 10 days, and then you were gonna go to France for a few days and do a retreat, and then you were gonna go back to South Africa and then go do some ministry in Zambia. Like, you had a whole life plan going.
I
And,
did.
making an emergency transition off the mission field with just a carry-on suitcase was not part of that plan.
No, it was not. And so I had planned to come home because my oldest nephew was graduating sixth grade. And if you understood the relationship that I have with my oldest nephew, with all my nephews, but this one in particular, you would understand that I will come home from South Africa to see him walk across that stage. And so I had already booked a ticket to come home. And a few days after booking that ticket, I had a we were in a like a all team meeting, and one of the staff members from the partner ministry that I worked with had had a conversation with someone. And in that conversation, a death threat against me was a death plot was revealed. And so in that meeting, I was pulled to the side and was told, the happenings of that meeting, what was said, and everything like that. From that meeting, I ended up going home, and I never went back to school ever since then. There was a period of 10 days between when I was told and when I would fly out of Cape Town. And so that's what led me home. What led me home was my nephew's graduation. What kept me home was, yes, partly this death threat, but then also when I arrived here, my PTSD became very apparent. It became apparent at your house. It became apparent at my friend Anne's house. And so, in navigating, I think a lot of the violence that I saw, some of the violence that I experienced with someone breaking into my home, and then another attempt to break into my home in a whole different, situation. A lot of that just came to the surface. And then I've heard, hundreds, literally hundreds of stories of kids and their trauma and working with kids and their trauma. And so by the time I got back to the States, I was completely hypervigilant. And I think being in the States just allowed me to, take a break for a minute, but it didn't actually look the way that I thought it would look. I thought this time, in the States would be a time to kind of settle and let things in South Africa, settle, and people to get their emotions under control and understand, killing me really isn't the way you want to go. Like, I kind of like life. I'm sure that you like me being alive. But in reality, it didn't shape up that way at all. I struggled with my with PTSD. I struggled with sleep. I struggled. I mean, you were there, so we all of that. But it was determined that I was not going to go back to the mission field, and that was the right decision. But in leaving South Africa, yes, I only came home with a small carry-on luggage. I didn't bring a computer. I was literally going to be in the States for 5 to 6 days, and then I was going to Paris for a mission retreat. And then I was going to head back to South Africa, exchange out clothes, and like 2 days later, I was heading up to Zambia to do some work in one of the villages there that we were associated with. And so that was it. I had sundresses and a hat and sandals, and
I
I was cute.
remember.
Yes. I was not prepared to be home.
You were prepared to go to the beach, and
I was.
that
I was prepared for sundresses and
Yeah.
being cute and things like that. I was definitely not prepared for staying here,
Yeah. Leaving your
forever. But
entire apartment and your car and everything behind
yeah.
suddenly. And people have to understand that you are like literally hiding in your apartment for about 8 days. After between the time of hearing about the death threat to when you were actually your plane ticket was taking you out of Cape Town, and so you were hiding in your apartment hoping that no one would come break into your apartment again, and then when you came here, there was your PTSD of the trauma that you had experienced, but then you had all this secondary trauma as a result of listening to all of the violent stories of the children, and that just kind of created a cascade of events that resulted in you transitioning off in an emergency fashion. So that kind of brings us up in the story. When we come back, we'll talk about you going back to South Africa. Did people want to come for you? How did you handle the death threat? How did you go back? And talk about the ministry and the future. So
Yeah.
sit tight, and we're talking about Monique's story for the very first time in public of her journey to and back to South Africa. So we'll see you right back here in 90 seconds.
Unshaken 2024 is coming. Join three of the most influential voices in cultural apologetics, Natasha Crane, Frank Turek, and Elisa Childers, as they equip Christians to live for Jesus in a world increasingly at odds with biblical Christianity. At Unshaken, you will join hundreds of others who are seeking to navigate the intersection of societal pressure and biblical truth, covering topics such as deconstruction, social justice, sexuality, and many more. Unshaken will teach you what the Bible has already said about the social issues we face today and equip you to stand firm in God's truth. The Unshaken Conference will be visiting Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, New York, and Austin, Texas in 2024. For details and tickets, visit unshakenconference.com and use code FRIEND20 to get 20% off your ticket price. Join us this year for an experience that will embolden and encourage your faith. That's code FRIEND20 at unshakenconference.com. We'll see you there.
And Lord willing, we will see you there. We will be having a table at all of the Unshaken shows. You were in Africa for the Detroit show, but Emily and I were there. I took my daughter, Emily, and she helped me with the table. And our friend Alexa Kramer helped as a volunteer as well at the table. But we will see you in Pittsburgh in May. So come find us there. We're not speaking, but we will be tabling and would love to hang out with you. So go check out the Unshaken tour.
Yes.
Okay, so that catches up to last year, as you said at the top of the show, the people from Apologetic South Africa reached out to you about coming back. Now, they weren't aware of all of your backstory. They had no idea of all of the drama and that. So it was a little bit of a journey for you to get to yes, precisely because of some of the things we've been talking about. But what was it in your heart that said, yes, I want to overcome all of my struggles with PTSD, and I want to potentially be discovered by people who wanted to kill me. I am ready to go to South Africa because I love the people so much.
Well, It was a long conversation. I was very nervous. I had done a talk in Cape Town virtually in late 2020, early 21. I had had another invitation from a completely different group, I want to say in 21 or 22. But I wasn't ready. I didn't think that it would be a successful trip. I didn't know that, as far as my mental health went, that I would be able to actually be present and to actually do the work that was needed in country while I was there. And so when Apologetic South Africa approached me at the like mid 23, it was something that I could really consider because I felt like I was just at a different place. I felt like, hey, it's been 5 years and my mental health is, not where it was before. I travel by myself now. In the beginning, people don't realize, but I didn't travel alone. You traveled with me everywhere that I went. And so,
And again, that was because of recovering from very significant PTSD. I mean, in the beginning, the prognosis was not good for recovery. So the fact that Monique travels all over now by herself, in my opinion, I would say in some doctors' opinions that we consulted with early on, is a miracle
It
that
is.
she is doing that you're doing the amount of work that you're doing.
I want to, sorry, Krista, I want to quickly address Susie's question. She says, that's so scary. Was it because you are American or Christian? And she says, okay, sorry not to, I'm sorry to pry. You're not prying. It's fine. I will not go into much detail out of respect for the person who initially made the threat because she was underage at the time. Let me see the best way I can say this is
I
that.
already wrote on there that I'm not sure we can say publicly. So if you don't want
No,
to
no,
say
no, no, no.
publicly,
It's
okay.
fine. And
All right.
I can say some things.
Okay.
I was a mandated reporter, and just like being a mandated reporter in the States, it comes with its own level of
Risk.
danger. Yeah, risk. And so because I was a mandated reporter, there was just risk that came along with that, and I fell into the middle of that risk. And so that is why there was a threat. It wasn't because I was an American. We do think that, someone trying to break in my house was because I was an American. I don't think anything was due to me, being a Christian or anything like that. And so I was saying that in looking at, how long I had been away from the country and things like that, I was like, maybe it'll be okay. I think more than anything, it was the journal that I found, where I was reading some of my thoughts about people and how my thoughts had changed, and how, even the work that I did from the place that I did it was so different, when I was reading the journal then. And so I was like, you know what? Maybe there's a way that I can go back into country and actually speak truth, actually speak the reality of the unity that we have as believers, as brothers and sisters, and really, just have that conversation, but also warn people about the critical social theories and let people know what's coming, what's being pumped from America, and the United Nations onto the African continent, so that many Christians are aware. And so that was really my driving force behind wanting to go, was to really speak truth from, as I have read the scriptures and thought about unity and thought about what it means to be a human person and all of that. How do I speak truth into, a country where I once had such very different worldviews?
That's good. And I think in a way for you, based on our conversations, it was a way of kind of offering a form of repair of like, hey, when I was there before, I was participating in the very framework that now I speak out against. I can go back. Now, you weren't going back to those same people or those same contexts. You were in other different contexts in different parts of the country. But just kind of symbolically going back to South Africa with a different message, a message of true gospel, hope and unity through the gospel.
Yeah, I initially started out in Johannesburg and Pretoria, which is on the eastern side of the country, and eventually made my way through to Cape Town. I did not go to the same area where I worked, but I definitely had to pass by within, 10 miles or so. And it was definitely unsettling. I am grateful because Apologetic South Africa, when I was in Cape Town, provided me with a bodyguard. And so I wasn't just, out there driving alone or, just with people, just out in the open. But I did have a bodyguard. They were very careful not to have me stay anywhere near where I worked. So I stayed about an hour, maybe a little bit more from the place or the area where I was originally working. They took so many steps to make sure not only that I was physically protected, but that emotionally and mentally, like I was okay, that everything that happened also helped me to feel like I was safe.
Because you were
And
nervous.
yeah,
I
oh, I
mean,
was very
you were
nervous.
nervous to go back. And even though the good people at Apologetic South Africa were like, hey, we're going to have this bodyguard, we're going to take precautions. And you were fairly transparent with them, like, hey, here's the things I've been through. Leading up to the, we were putting on a public face of like, yeah, this is going to be great. We're doing this fundraiser and blah, blah, blah. But behind the scenes, it was mid-January. You hadn't bought your tickets yet.
And I think that's the hard part. It's because in my heart, I really felt like this was something that I was supposed to do. Like I had prayed about it. I didn't have any reservation that I should not go. But there's also the dynamic of fear. And I think fear is a very natural thing that people
Sure.
experience. And so I was also dealing with that. And I remember coming up even to the day before where I had such heightened fear that I was like, I don't know that I can actually go through with it. But on the, same hand, I did not think that I was supposed to stay home. I knew that I was supposed to go, whether the worst happened, and someone caught me, and I got caught up out there, or not, I was supposed to go. And so at that point, it was like, how are you going to push through the fear? And so I called on friends and was like, hey, I need you guys to pray for me. The church, you were there when the church prayed for me before I left. It was very much a thing of I know that this is what I'm supposed to do, and I am scared as all get out, but I'm still gonna have to do it because this is what I believe the Lord is calling me to. I
But in order to
have
get there was a mindset of like, I'm prepared to die, even though that
yes.
felt that's probably realistically like way out there in terms of the possibilities of it happening for you
No, but
because,
no, it's not. It's not way out there.
okay.
I mean, when a threat is issued in South Africa, especially from the area that threat is issued, it's not way out there to think about that threat actually taking place. And so, and I've seen it while I lived in country. It
They'll
this
kill you
person
at the
got knocked off.
airport. They'll kill you at the
And
TSA.
that's what I saw before I left.
Yeah.
Someone was shot while trying to go through TSA. Someone else was shot miles away from where the initial threat was made, all the way up in an area by where I lived, but they traced that person and they found him, and the assignment was handled. It's not uncommon. I know people personally who, thankfully, she had bulletproof glass on her car, but was attacked in her car and with a brick, and they tried to bash her window in and things like that. And so I've seen, what a threat can mean and what a threat can do. And so no, it's not very far-fetched if the right person knew and the right person still, wanted
And you had done
to attack me.
a radio interview before you left, and you thought, well, if somebody hears this radio interview that's going nationally, they recognize my name. The threats, there was a lot happening for you emotionally of what's going to go when I go there. Now, you spoke at a women's conference on the Johannesburg side. We've got a few pictures of that. Bob's going to show them here on the screen. So it looks like these are maybe some of the ladies worshiping or something.
Yes. And
there's another one of some of the people. So looks like a Q&A time here. And in the background there is one of the your organizers is Suzette. She's there on the left of the screen.
She's the blonde woman on the far left of the screen, all the way at the
in the back.
Second woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she was
was such a godsend.
Yeah.
Just such a
she drove you around the whole time and all of that.
Made sure that everything was taken care of. She's like had everything logistically taken care of. She was just so attentive and really helped my time there go well for me, especially emotionally.
Yeah.
When I wasn't sure how I was going to respond in country. And she was just so, such a little a ray of sunshine and a breath of fresh air. I'm so grateful for her. Out of all the people that could have hosted me, I stayed in her house. I got to know her family and her kids. You know, she traveled with me to Cape Town. Out of all the people that I could have potentially stayed with while I was in South Africa, I am so glad that it was Suzette.
That was a real provision for you. Now, here's a picture of you speaking, and then we've got another one here.
That I make.
All your faces. This one's a lovely shot. The photographer did such a nice job. So that was kind of a big event, right, when you got there. So Friday, Saturday kind of a thing. You did a lot of talks about unity, and that brings me kind of to a question that our first friend Chris Gangstead asked on YouTube. He wanted to know, like, how are the Christian churches doing in pushing back against racial inequities? And you know, what is the state of the church there when it comes to the conversation about race?
So there are several issues. I think trying to figure out where to start with this. I think that many churches can be stuck in their ways. And so one of the things I learned, I actually 4 years of living there did not know this, that there are actually like white townships as well. When I think of a township, I always usually think of Black areas, but that there are actually these all white areas where it would not be safe today for someone who is not white to go in. And they have these churches there, and these churches are, you know, run by mainstream denominations. And the denomination is well aware that if someone—
Would you qualify it as being race exclusive? Is that what you're saying?
Race exclusive and racist. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And so,
I was trying to make sure that that's what you were saying and I was understanding correctly.
Yeah. That there is this idea that if you're not white, you shouldn't be in this area and you can, you know, be harmed for going in this area. But that also includes the church community. And so where I could possibly see someone planting a church there so that they can go and make a difference, so that they can go and break down some of those barriers, so that they can do evangelism and bring people to repentance and things like that. No, these mainstream denominations are just there, you know, going with the flow and upholding this racial division or racism, which is, you know, ethnic partiality and hatred. And so they're upholding sin. And so there's that aspect of it.
So it's not a lighthouse in a dark place. It's rather participating with the racial partiality in the name of Jesus.
Yes. And so there's that. There are also, you know, churches that are just going along with their own flow, who are completely unaware of things like CRT or woke ideology and all of that. And so they're just going along. I've had a couple of conversations with pastors who are asking the question, you know, what can the church do that is not the socialist lane that the government wants to enforce, or that, the university thinkers want to enforce. I wonder if many of the churches feel like this is such a huge problem that they don't know where to begin to tackle some of it. However, I did have a meeting with a pastor and his wife, and they actually have a very multi-ethnic church. They have two locations in the Pretoria area, and their churches are very, very multi-ethnic. And when I asked them, well, what do you do, to make sure that your leadership is multi-ethnic? Like, are you just going out and plucking off leaders who are of different skin color than you to make sure that you have this diverse leadership? And his answer was no. His answer was, I look for the qualifications of an elder. And in looking for the qualifications of an elder and discipling people, people just naturally arise to the surface from all different backgrounds, socioeconomic statuses, skin colors, and all of that. So yeah, I'm just now beginning to touch the surface on what many churches are doing there. I had probably 3 to 4 conversations with pastors where it seems like they're still struggling to figure out, like, how do we address such gross inequities within our country?
Do you feel like they
All right,
have a
yeah.
robust enough theology, at least to get them started with like the basics of, unity in Christ and partiality and like, or are they kind of a little bit more behind us and they're kind of more even beginner stages of that understanding?
I think some do. I
Okay.
think some have a robust understanding of the scriptures and ethnic partiality and what does it mean to be brothers and sisters in Christ. I think part of the problem that was actually discipling the people who, for many, have grown up under an apartheid regime and
Okay.
or have parents who have grown up under this, and there's still bitterness or confusion or a desire to just, you be you, and that's how you've always been. And I'm just going to be over here and do me and be me with my people instead of calling people to actually come up to a higher standard of true unity where, those things no longer separate us as believers. When, we repent and we come into to Christ's family, we are now brothers and sisters. How do we participate from that position? The other thing too that is interesting is the idea of apologetics in South Africa. This is, I'm
Yeah,
going to say, a
I want to get into that because you had some events at universities with our friends at Ratio Christi. In fact, Bob's got a couple of pictures for those. Oh yeah, and there was a gift bag at the women's conference. They include the Reconciled. So I just want to say thank you to our donors who gave a couple of Giving Tuesdays ago so that we could purchase physical copies of Reconciled that we have here at the house. Monique took a whole box of them over there to gift to our friends at Apologetic South Africa, and they gave a number of them out at the women's conference. So thank you to all of our donors who gave for that campaign. Okay, now let's go to here's another picture with some of the ladies from the conference. Now these are all, I think you said that these are all colored women.
those are color women. The conference was very multi-ethnic or
Okay.
multi, cultural. And so there were colored women, there were white women, there was a black woman there. Yeah,
That's great.
it was good. It was.
So, all right, let's go to the next one. Now, this is a shot of one of your university events. You were speaking at a Ratio Christi chapter. And for those people who don't know what Ratio Christi is, it's kind of, if people have ever heard of Campus Crusade or InterVarsity, it's these campus chapters. Well, these Ratio Christi focuses on apologetics. And they are a global ministry, and there's a number of chapters at universities in South Africa. Our friend Dr. Corey Miller is the CEO of Ratio Christi. He's also on our academic advisory council. So I'm super glad you got to do these events. But talk to us about the events here. I mean, we're going to show the picture of Dr. Simon Brace and his wife. He heads up the Ratio Christi in South Africa and all of that region. So talk to us about these university events. You haven't done really secular university style events before.
No, I haven't. It was very interesting. But there, I spoke at four different Ratio Christi chapters. So Ratio Christi, as Krista mentioned, are dialogue opportunities and ministry opportunities at, you know, primarily secular universities. I don't know if they have any at Christian University. No, Biola had one. But I spoke at the Ratio Christi chapter for Johannesburg, Potch, the University of Cape Town, and the University of Stellenbosch. And in these meetings, anyone is able to come. And whether you are a believer, atheist, agnostic, doesn't really matter. You can come.
Socialist.
You can come and hear the speaker, and then you can have dialogue. You can ask your questions. You can debate, whatever. And so I did four of those while I was there. The one that it was on the screen was from the University of Cape Town. And it was just a time of sharing, you know, about our unity in Christ and why I believe that the scriptures offer us a better hope for ethnic unity than socialism or critical theory ever can. And there was some pushback at this event, but that was okay. I think the foundation for us as believers is always going to lead us to a better hope. And so as I was going back and forth, especially with one gentleman, you know, as I would put out an answer, eventually he got to the point of being like, well, I guess I'll let somebody else go. Because there really wasn't another answer to be put forward. You know, if I'm quoting your people to you, you know, like, how do you're now in an argument with your own people. I'm not at this point even quoting the scripture. We're just talking about the problems within the framework of your own, you know, within like socialist people or critical theory people, critical race theory people, and looking just at almost like a natural law position of how do you really make this work? How do you make this make sense? I thought it was very interesting that there were, especially at this UCT event, there were many Black and colored students who pushed back against white people who are wanting to promote a more socialist or critical theory framework.
So in that context, the white participants were more pushing the critical theory side, and the Black and colored students were like, no,
yeah,
we don't want to go down this path. And Jenny's asking a question on YouTube. Did you see any similarities in attitudes between there and here? So maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think much of the conversation on critical race theory is imported directly from America into a university like the University of Cape Town, or because so many people desire, or especially young people, I don't want to say to be like Americans, but a lot of that thought, a lot of the critical theory, you know, ways of thinking do get adopted by young people there. And so the conversation sounds pretty much the exact same conversation of the marginalized, standing for all the people, standing for the queer, standing for, you know, all, the entire, you know, all the critical social theory frameworks, you know, feminist theory, how do we stand for women? And, you know, what does this mean to stand for the disabled? And, you know, it all gets clumped into this one bucket of marginalized and oppressed, whether they are biblically defined as marginalized and oppressed or not. And now, it felt like being back in the States in some of these conversations.
But this really is, and this is an opinion, and I'm not saying Monique shares this opinion with me, but to me, when I hear this sort of thing, it just feels like so cringy, because it's like a new form of colonization. Once again, we are exporting, in this case, what I would say is the worst of our ideas from the West, and bringing those into Africa, and they are getting adopted and beginning that toxic pollution into the minds and hearts of African young people. And I think it just is so sad to me that that's happening. But it to me, that's just kind of another version of colonization. Now, you also did a kids event. So what kind of questions came up there?
Oh, okay. So I spoke at a youth group, and it was young people between 11 and 17. And they just had some of the best questions. What's God's race? How did race come to be? Am I a racist? I'm trying to think of all the questions that they asked. I had one person who caught me after, who just told me about her experience with being white and having an interaction with someone who, even though I'm sure they didn't know, you know, she's like 13, 14 years old, they, you know, her and her friends weren't aware that they were being impacted by critical race theory. But this idea that she was, you know, a bad person and a racist because she was white, and, you know, there was nothing that she could do about it. That was just her lot in life, was to be a racist. And so she was asking me what I thought about that, and is that true, and how should she respond, and all of those things. And so I had got to have a very nice conversation with the young person there. So yeah, they had some great questions. We talked a lot about bringing clarity to the racial chaos that's happening all around us. And when I asked them certain questions, every hand went up. Like, how many of you have ever heard of the term woke? How many of you know what it means? Have you ever seen, you know, someone say that you need to be standing for all Black people? And it, you know, if you don't stand for all Black people, what does that mean? Well, it means that I don't like Black people, or it means that I'm a racist, or if I don't post a Black square, then I should be, you know, this, I'm considered that over there. So yeah, it was a lot of the same conversations, but they did have really good questions. I've never been asked, what is God's race?
Now, when they asked, am I racist? I assume they're asking if they're racist, not if you are racist, or were people asking,
yeah,
are they racist?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about apologetics, and then we'll round it out here. We're running out of time, but I do want to give you a few minutes to talk about some of your personal things that you enjoy about South Africa. But I do want to talk about apologetics and the work that Apologetics South Africa is doing there. Like, is apologetics on the rise? Is it really having a hard time getting off the ground? Like, how are African Christians engaging with the topic of apologetics? Is it growing?
Yeah, so I can't speak for the entire country, but what I can say is that organizations like Apologetics South Africa and Ratio Christi are really doing a good work to bring apologetics to the country. When I was there between 2014 and 2018, I didn't see any apologetics being had. And now to see Apologetics South Africa having a Bible college and equipping people to be able to go out and defend their faith, to think logically about their faith, is awesome. Now they are in Pretoria and they have, you know, some reach into some other areas, but they definitely need support in doing that. And they need people to come over and to speak and to share the truth of just not just the gospel, but to share the truth of what, you know, some of these apologetic issues are, things like deconstruction. Oh my gosh, I spoke with so many people who had never heard of the term deconstruction before. There are so many people who are asking, you know, basically Natasha Crane's question, how do I keep my kids on God's side? Or, you know, in my church, what do we do with the pastor who supports LGBTQ+? How do we think about people who are in the church who identify as LGBTQ+? There's a huge need for apologetics in South Africa. And I'm grateful for Ratio Christi and for Apologetic South Africa because they're taking a stand and saying, yes, we love the Lord our God with all of our heart, but we also love him with all of our mind as well. We can think logically about our faith and give an actual defense for the faith that we have.
Do you think, though, that apologetics could be seen as kind of a white thing? That it's, you know, just an American thing? Or do you feel like there's pockets now that are of the church that are starting to embrace it?
I'm not sure. That's a question that I have still yet to ask is, you know, how is apologetics seen on more of the large scale? Is it seen like something that is coming out from America where, you know, there's a lot of people who are skeptical about Americans and what comes out from America? And so I don't, in what I saw, I didn't see any like stark resistance to apologetics. I actually saw people who were very grateful to learn their faith and to understand it in a new way. But I don't know if maybe they might say in country that it's a slow road because people just aren't familiar with apologetics, or maybe they don't see it necessary. So I'm even still doing more digging and having more conversations in that regard.
Okay. So Chris is asking the question that everybody wants to know is, tell us about the food.
The best. Oh my gosh.
So that's one of your favorite things about South Africa is the food. You've mentioned before on the show that you're very gluten sensitive and that sort of a thing. But a funny thing happens when you go to South Africa when it comes to gluten.
I can eat anything there. It doesn't matter. I can eat bread. I am not impacted the way I am with food here. And so I ate everything. A lot of lamb, a lot of meat. I think we had ostrich there.
You had cinnamon rolls.
I did. I had, yes. But there, I didn't have any kudu or springbok, which is kind of a deer kind of meat.
Now we have a picture here of a carrot. And
yes. So carrots and avocados and things like that, they grow so much bigger than what they do.
So you're showing us a picture of a carrot that's bigger than the neck of a wine bottle by maybe double. That's a very large carrot, unless it's an optical illusion with the camera.
No, so that's actually one of the small carrots. I was peeling carrots and I was like, people just do not believe how big things get here. Like the avocados that we get out here in California, that's the size of the seed in an African avocado.
Wow.
But that carrot was bigger in width than the neck of the wine bottle and almost as long as the wine bottle itself. It was, yeah, there is something about the soil in South Africa or in Africa that just grows things to ginormous proportions.
And the food supply just seems to be so much more pure there. I mean, cause you struggle with food sickness all the time. People don't know. It's just, you're very sensitive and you often have digestive problems, but when you go there, it's not like that. And so it just really kind of raises some questions about our food supply, but we'll table that for now. Now I know that you did a lot of speaking. You spoke almost every day. This was not a vacation. You did multiple radio and podcast interviews. You were doing a lot. It was exhausting. You took, like, I think 2 days of the trip to see some old friends, some people that you knew when you were there before, when you were a missionary. So we've got a couple of pictures. Here, tell us who these special people are.
So that is my friend Lee and her husband Hensel. And Lee was like my closest friend in South Africa. We were just two peas in a pod. We were thick as thieves. We did everything together. And it was really good to be back with them. I did not get to see everyone that I wanted to see. The time went so quick. The dates of my trip actually changed. And so we pushed the trip out maybe 2 to 3 weeks like further. So I was supposed to leave in the middle of February and I didn't leave until the end of February. which meant that, some of the days were definitely different than
Yeah.
how I planned it. And so I do feel sad that I couldn't see some of my other friends, but I definitely needed to see Lee and Hensel and their kids. It's been almost
And all
six
their
years.
extended family, you guys had a couple of gatherings because that's a big deal in South Africa. They took you to this special place. Bob's got a picture of that. It's called the Postcard.
It's called Postcard Cafe. And so this was on my last day in Cape Town. We went and had breakfast here. I took this picture with my phone, and it's called Postcard Cafe because wherever you sit in this restaurant, you get a view that looks like a postcard. And so, yes,
So you sat
that is
outside with
Postcard
all the
Cafe.
bugs?
No, I was actually inside.
Oh,
And
okay.
so many of the restaurants in South Africa are kind of open. People
Okay.
don't mind the bugs, they don't mind the bees. And here I am, like EpiPen in hand, because I can't get stung by the bees and things like that. But I was surprised I didn't see any baboons. This area, if you go maybe a half mile up, it's right at the bottom of a hiking trail where there are tons of baboons. I actually went hiking on one of my birthdays while I was there and ran into a family of baboons, and I ran for my life, even though you're not supposed to run when you see baboons because they can give chase, and if you have food, they will get you for it. They're very aggressive. So
So you saw a
yeah, I was.
spider, and we're gonna cap it off here with Monique's adventure in the house. What happened when she thought a hummingbird flew into the house? Because they don't have screens on their windows, right?
So no, they don't. No one really has screens or screens on their doors or things like that. It's like you open the window and things just come in and then they leave and nobody really thinks about it or cares about it except for me. And so when I turned around, I was in the house and I turned around and I was like, oh my gosh, there's a hummingbird inside of the house. Like right there, there's a hummingbird. And my friend turned around and she was like, oh my gosh. And so I thought we were both thinking it was a hummingbird until she got a closer look and it was a moth the size of a hummingbird. And I mean, it was like, hummingbirds kind of have that vertical kind of posture. This moth had the same thing. And so, yes,
You said
there was a it was a mess.
at the very beginning of the video, people will hear you say something to the effect of, "Oh no, we can't live like this," or "We ain't living like this." All right, here it is. So you tried to kill it with a bag. You're swinging a bag.
Because I couldn't touch it with my hands.
So you had to resort to violence against the poor moth.
Now, that moth was so big, though, that that did not kill it. I thought it was dead, but my friend's son ended up coming, collecting the moth, and releasing it outside. And I was just grateful. I was grateful that it didn't end up in my room. I am grateful that it didn't accidentally touch me. It because yeah, I would have had to end my trip early because
Would have to fly back.
I could not. I could have flown back on the back of that moth. It was so big. I could not. I want to get to Jenny's question. So in response to Chris's question, I feel like all of South Africa depends on like it. South African food is just good. It's not like one group makes the best food. It's the food is just good. There's like different kind of what we would call beef jerky, they call biltong, and there's different types of desserts, and oh, it's just all so good. But no, not just one group. Jenny asked, did you find people were relieved when they heard your message, Monique. So glad you got to go. Yes, when people actually heard especially I feel like the idea that, we really are only one human race and that if you're white, you don't have to wear this guilt. that if you participated in racism and you intentionally, you know, held these racist ideas and views, that if you repent, you are forgiven, and you are too a part of the household and family of God. I think that there were many people who were relieved. And I also think that there were many Black and colored people who were relieved, and felt that there was support even in the way that they are seeing things in not wanting the critical theory. So yes.
All right.
Crystal, were you going to ask me another question?
No, I just want to kind of leave it, first of all, with a thank you to our donors once again who gave toward the campaign so that Monique could go and maybe talk to them about, will you ever go back? Have you broken the ice now and kind of overcome the PTSD? How did that go? And will you go back?
So there is conversation about, you know, what would it look like for me to come back, for me to do more work in country around the idea of critical theory or critical race theory and unity in the body of Christ and things like that. So there are conversations happening. I would definitely go back. I definitely feel more comfortable and more confident in knowing that this is something that I can do. And also just more comfortable and confident in the fact that every day that is assigned for my life is assigned and issued by God, and I can trust him. And I know that, yeah, that he's going to be with me and go before me, and nothing is going to happen that is not already, nothing's going to happen that he's not aware of.
Yeah. I like how what it says in Psalm 139, it says that all of our days are written in God's books. And, you know, that's something we can rest in. I think, you know, as we move forward, I think it's just a wonderful testimony to how far the ministry has come, that we can begin to minister globally now more. And maybe this will open up some other opportunities in other countries that are struggling with different ethnic issues. Because as you and I have said all along, the problems of race and ethnicity and partiality are not a uniquely American problem. It is a human problem. Now, it might show up differently in different contexts and different cultures, but sin is the problem, is the root problem. And partiality is a particular type of sin, but it is not a special sin. It is not the worst sin. It is not an unforgivable sin. And God's solutions are adequate no matter where we live. And so hopefully people were encouraged by your report tonight. And just thanks to all our donors for making it possible. When you guys give, we want to let you know how your money's being used. It makes podcasts like this possible. It makes the reconciled curriculum possible that we can give away. It makes it possible for us to sow into the lives of others and even the missionaries there in South Africa. We want to do what we can to continue to spread the message and the hope of the gospel. So any last words there, Monique?
No, just a big thank you so much for standing with us as we continue to equip the body of Christ to be able to have conversations on race, justice, and unity. And we continue to, you know, stand for truth in regards to the critical social theories. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your prayers. We could not do this without you. And so, yeah, I will keep you guys posted on any upcoming trips. I definitely feel better about going.
Look at the Lord.
Won't he do it?
Won't he do it? All right, my friend, we will be back next week with another live show. Monique will be in studio with me. We're going to be talking to our friend, Dr. Jay Richards, about the World Economic Forum. It was rescheduled from last month, and we are going to be doing a deep dive into globalism and all of that crazy agenda. And so you will not want to miss that discussion with Dr. Jay Richards. Also, make sure you are subscribed to the new Off Code YouTube channel, where you can follow the adventures of Monique and Kevin. I was so surprised on the road, Monique, how many people who watch the show have no awareness of off-code. So that tells me we're not doing enough to promote the show on here. And maybe just tell people really quick, like 30 seconds, of what off-code is and what you and Kevin are trying to do with that podcast.
Yeah, so Off Code is a podcast directed toward the Black community, looking at issues that are usually blamed on whiteness and looking at how, you know, if we're blaming everything on whiteness, then what truly is the responsibility of the Black person within the community? And so we're trying to tackle some of those issues. You know, how do we talk about abortion? Abortion's been blamed on whiteness for a while, you know, but what is our responsibility as African-Americans within our nation and within our community to help our community come to a place of flourishing? And so Kevin and I sit and have conversations, or we interview people just to help us all, not just Black people, but us understand what are some of the issues within the Black community.
Yes. And it's not just a podcast for Black people.
But that's who the conversation is aimed toward.
Yeah. Yes. But it's very educational. I love being there when they're recording them. I have learned a ton by listening to the Off Code podcast. So go check that out. Make sure you are subscribed to their new YouTube channel. So we can get to 1,000, because once we get to 1,000, then it unlocks extra powers that we can do with the channel. But we've got to hit the magical number of 1,000. So you can do that to help us out. All right, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next week again. Live show next week on the World Economic Forum with Dr. Jay Richards from the Heritage Foundation. We'll see you then. God bless.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to All the Things. Be sure to subscribe to our website at allthethingsshow.com. And find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you stream your podcast. Be sure to hit that subscribe button and the bell so you'll receive alerts when we post new shows. We'll see you next week.